Ads, schmads. If you don't want ads, that's okay. Choose the Dave McWilliams Plus option on Apple Podcasts. And hey presto, no ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
This podcast is powered by Acast.
How you doing there? It is obviously podcast time. John is reminiscing here about slow sets.
Again.
And on my part, I break out in a rash every time I hear the opening bars of Freebird by Lynyrd Skynyrd, because it means that the ska bit is over and I now have to ask him to dance. And the whole, that there's just the dilemma, the maze in my head, the miasma of, oh my God. Anyway, these are...
And people just are moving into the darkness. Get away from me. Here comes McWilliams.
Yes, exactly.
Oh no, predator. Hiding over here.
Anyway, it's lovely to be back in the basement talking to John about all sorts of things. But today we're going to talk about plutocracy, John.
Yes.
Right? Plutocracy, a democracy run by rich people. And the reason we're going to talk about that is if you are watching American in particular politics at the moment, what you will see is an extraordinary dash for cash on the part of all American politicians to finance the presidential election.
Yeah.
And in a system where there is no cap on how much money, so the extraordinary thing, you might have recently seen a couple of billionaires are all coming out in support of Donald Trump,
yeah.
Right? People who actually were against Trump. Why? Because Joe Biden's going to introduce a billionaire tax. That's what he said.
Yeah.
If he gets elected. So you've got all these
billionaires. That's what he needs to do.
God. Yeah, it's amazing. But you've got all these billionaires and nobody says, hold on a second, this is not consistent with democracy. So basically democracy's promise is one man, one vote.
Yeah.
It bends towards equality, right? Capitalists' promise and extreme capitalism's promise is one man, loads of votes if you're rich enough, right?
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
And so we're going to talk about that today, but we're not going to discuss it amongst ourselves. There's a fascinating character called Nick Hanauer, who is a serial entrepreneur, a very, very wealthy man, who about 20 years ago came out and said, hold on a second. Inequality, as exists in the United States, where, for example, Bernie was saying that three individuals own more wealth than the bottom 50%, is inconsistent with the democracy. His name is Nick Hanauer. He's from Seattle. Fascinating guy. Google him. He's got an amazing podcast called Pitchfork Economics, right? And Pitchfork Economics is based on the idea, and he said it, if we do not tackle inequality, people will rebel with pitchforks and they'll come for the rich.
Yeah.
And that's his idea. He's basically, how do we actually, it's a self-preservation idea for rich people, is to pay more taxes and to be more involved in society and to be more generous and to have more responsibility, because with great wealth comes great responsibility.
Yeah.
So why don't we go to Seattle and talk to Nick Hanauer? I can guarantee you this will be a fantastic discussion. Now, for the last, I would say, decade odd, I have been following a prolific businessman from Seattle called Nick Hanauer online, watching him on YouTube videos, and more importantly, listening to his amazing podcast. And I really recommend it to all of you, Pitchfork Economics. Now, the interesting thing about Nick is that when you hear a poor guy telling rich guys they should pay more tax, well, that's fair enough, because you're a poor guy. But when you hear a rich guy telling other rich guys that, in fact, the wealthy need to shoulder the burden of society a little bit more, then you wake up. And Nick has been one of those guys. So it's great to talk to you. He's on the line from the West Coast of the States. Nick, how are you? Good morning, I think it is to you.
Good morning. It is morning. Good to see you, David. Thank you for having me.
Not at all. Look, I've been following your stuff, right? I think you wrote an article, I suspect, about 15, maybe 14 years ago, saying, hold on a second, the plutocrats, the very, very wealthy, need to wake up to inequality. And this, I think, shocked everybody because you were a self-professed plutocrat. You were a guy who set up loads of businesses, loads of cash, and you said, hold on a second, guys, this has to change. Explain that position to me, and then we'll meander on in our conversation.
Yeah, so I have been at this probably since about 2006 or seven. The Pitchforks piece was in 2014, but in about, I think about 2007, I got my hands on the IRS tax tables, which showed the evolution of income shares in the United States. And I learned this unbelievable thing, which was that in 1980, the top 1% of Americans shared about 8% of national income, while the bottom 50% of Americans shared about 18% of national income. But then that by 2007, I believe it was, the share of income to the top 1% had risen from 8 to 24%, and the share for the bottom 50% had fallen from 18 to 12.
Wow.
And, you know, I knew that the country had become more unequal, but those numbers scared the crap out of me. And I did this very simple thing, is I just took all those numbers and we stuck them in an Excel spreadsheet, and you just assumed that the trend would continue for another 30 years, as it were. And, you know, I can't remember precisely the numbers, but at the end of another 30 years, the top 1% were going to have 45% of national income, and the bottom 50% were going to have like 5 or 6% of national income. And you don't have to be a PhD economist or a well-trained political scientist to come to the conclusion that if that circumstance became true, that the United States would no longer be a capitalist democracy, it would be a feudal authoritarian state. That there was simply no way to sustain either a market economy or a democracy in a country where a few people got everything and everybody else got nothing. And so I started working on that problem and writing about it and activating myself and other people about it. And then in 2014, I believe I wrote that Pitchforks piece, which made that, you know, argument in a relatively entertaining way, which was that if we don't get our shit together, if the wealthy don't begin to come to terms with this problem, then the pitchforks would come. And of course they have, right? Like Donald Trump is the instantiation of what happens when you immiserate the majority of citizens. And I think that, you know, David, it should be said, and I know you know, but your listeners may not know, that I effectively devote full time to this issue now. Yeah. And I've written a bunch of books on it, and I study it very, very carefully. I don't have a PhD in economics, but
which qualifies you for this podcast, by the way.
Yeah.
We have a PhD free zone.
Yeah. Okay. But exactly. So I think for most people, they think of inequality as merely an economic inconvenience to the people who are being unequal, or however you want to say it. But that is not true. It's a much more serious thing, because as humans, we evolved as social animals, relational animals, where status and how we fit into society is extraordinarily important to us. And the problem with rising and radical inequality in a democracy is that it shreds the reciprocity norms that make social cohesion and hence democracy possible. So it's not possible to sustain a democracy in a society where a few people are winning and everybody else is losing, which is the story of the economy in the United States of America for the last 50 years. I mean, save, by the way, the last couple, where wages at the bottom have really come up. So, you know, nobody has a stake in a stable society like the people at the top.
Well, absolutely. Like yeah, yeah.
You know, and so, you know, I have for a very long time felt very strongly about addressing this issue. And look, David, I don't want to pay more taxes, right? It's not like I'm some kind of martyr.
Yeah.
But equally, I don't really like to eat vegetables.
But they're good for you.
I'm not crazy about exercising.
Yeah, but it's
good for
you. There's
this class of things that you do in your life because you know you need to. And paying working people enough so that they can live in security and dignity and paying enough taxes as a rich person so you can sustain society is the price that you pay for living in a high-functioning society. Full stop. There are no counter examples to that. No, so here we are.
You're absolutely right. And I want to go a little bit deeper because when I listen to you, I hear words like justice. I hear words like trust. I hear words like collaboration. I hear words like cooperation.
Yes.
And when I listen to other members of our benighted tribe, I hear words like competition.
Yes.
I hear words like best in the market. I hear words like, you know, moving towards, you know, winner takes all, right?
Yeah.
And that is an inevitable consequence, or so it's painted, of economics. But when I listen to your podcast, Pitchfork, I'm hearing justice. Not just equality, but cooperation, collaboration. And I'm hearing those sociological, what I would describe as gelling agents that are necessary for a community. Start with a family, but then get wider to function.
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, I don't need to tell you, but orthodox economics is an internally consistent and mathematically elegant framework of thought, but it has no connection to what actually happens on planet Earth.
It's kind of bonkers, but
That's right. It's sort of like modern astrology.
Well, it's really funny because next week I teach a course in the university here in Trinity to the master's students and the MBAs. And very, very much we go in and we sit down on Monday morning, it'll be Monday week, and I say, okay, guys, what have you learned about economics over the last while? And they will come up with a whole series of sort of superannuated economics 101. And I'm like,
right,
put that in a little box and forget about it for the next couple of weeks. So explain to me this idea, the difference between the real world and...
Yeah, so modern, orthodox economic thinking is predicated on a series of assumptions about the world and about people that are mathematically tractable. And they were plausible 100 years ago, but they're just not true, starting with our assumptions about human behavior, right? That people are reliably rational and selfish. Now, if you assume that people are reliably rational and selfish, and you make some other assumptions about our ability to raise using Bayesian logic and that we have infinite willpower and perfect foresight and all this other crap, then you can build a relatively easy model of human behavior. The problem is that that is not what people are like. It's just not true.
Yes.
People are not reliably rational and selfish. We occasionally can be selfish and rational, but mostly we are intuitively moral, other regarding, and cooperative. And we are emotional and social reasoners, not individual rational reasoners. And the thing that is so important about that is that if you assume that people are selfish and you look around the world at all the unambiguous prosperity in it, then you have to conclude by definition that it was selfishness that's the cause of our prosperity. And the more selfish we are, the more prosperity we create. And you end up with this ludicrous idea that somehow selfishness is efficient and that the greedier we are, the more righteous we become because somehow that's driving the economy forward. All of this is just utter nonsense. It is simply not true that competition is the defining characteristic of human societies. Yes, we can compete, but if you actually look at what happens in markets, 99% of the activity is cooperation.
Exactly.
A company is a symphony of cooperation. A society is a symphony of cooperation. And occasionally, yes, those companies compete with other companies, but mostly it is just true that cooperation is humanity's superpower. And if you start from that idea, then how you construct a society becomes much clearer, and you know, you will make much better policy decisions.
I mean, it's again, when you step back, we're going to come back to America, and we're going to come back to how the largest country or the largest economy in the world adopted policies that are explicitly slightly anti-human, if we talk about it, right?
Yeah.
But if 100%. You go back, you know, if you go back and you think something like the Ten Commandments, I mean, what is it other than a fella saying, look, there's a load of us working together, we're living together, here's a set of rules, right? And these rules are largely, this is the way to behave with each other. They're kind of a set of rules for cooperation. They're called the Ten Commandments and religion and all that. And actually what they were was like, how do we all live in reasonable harmony together?
The Ten Commandments are economic principles.
Yeah, and cooperative principles.
You can call them moral principles, but they're economic principles.
This is what I'm saying, is that I think it was David Hume, the Scottish fellow in the Scottish Enlightenment, and I think Hume said something that when humans get together, they, in any large group, they require three things for them to work. One is language, so they can communicate.
Yeah.
The other is law, so they know the rules of the game. And the third one is money, but money to allow them to collaborate, because money is a social technology, right?
That's right.
So, I mean, what you're saying is that all of this is so evidently true in your life and in your work and in your society.
Yeah.
And yet we have the United States Senate, Congress, and the President of the United States kind of entrapped by an ideology which is kind of anti-human.
Yeah, correct. Everything you just said was true, with one exception, which is the current president of the United States.
That's true.
President Biden, who is the first post-Reagan president. He is the first post-neoliberal president. And as a consequence, he's the first president we've had really since Roosevelt to begin to make policy on a what I would call a rational basis. And the middle-out framework that those guys are using to think about policy and to make policy is the first time the United States has moved in the right direction in a decisive way, really, in my lifetime. So, David, I'm not sure if you know, but the entire framework for the Biden administration is this thing called middle-out economics. This very simple notion that wealth does not trickle down from the top. It is built from the bottom up and the middle out. That a thriving middle class isn't the consequence of economic growth. It is the cause of economic growth. And that middle-out framework is something I have been working on for, I don't know, 15 years. And fortunately, it is something I have collaborated with a bunch of other economists. And over 10 or 15 years, a small group of us realized that this whole neoliberal framework was a pack of lies. And for as much grief as Biden is given for being as old as he is, there is one miraculous thing about his age, and that is he remembers the before times.
Yes.
He is so old.
Yeah.
He is so old that he remembers a time in America when we actually did economic policy making that was rational, that was focused on the majority of citizens. So I don't know Joe Biden super well, but I've had at least a 1 2-hour one-on-one with him. And what I can tell you about that man is that his central political belief, the thing that animates him in his life, is the idea that if you take care of the ordinary citizen, the typical family, everything else in politics takes care of itself. That this is the simplest idea, that if you just make sure that the typical family thrives, then everything else will be fine. And that has to be the core idea of modern economic policymaking. A thriving middle class causes both economic growth and political stability.
Now, it's interesting the way you put that, that Biden has seen the past, and having witnessed and lived in the past and having been a product of the past, he has an echo in his head of what things used to be like.
Before neoliberalism ate the brains of everybody else.
John likes it. John's a resident lefty in the basement here, right? I'm typical equivocating, sitting in the middle right.
But wishy-washy.
Wishy-washy.
But, dude, look, Obama, who was dazzling and brilliant and a super fine man, right? He was president for 8 years, but his presidency was largely a failure because he was neoliberal. And all of the economists who surrounded him were neoliberal. Look, if you believe that raising the minimum wage will kill jobs, if you believe that the economy is a Pareto optimal equilibrium within which if one thing goes up, another thing goes down, and that therefore, if you raise the minimum wage, there will be corresponding job loss. If you believe stuff like that, which is sort of the central idea of neoliberalism, how do you help people?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right.
How do you help people? You cannot help people, right? It's just, you know, neoliberalism, as you know, is a protection racket for the rich. But it has completely eaten the brains of policymakers on both the left and the right in the United States over the last 50 years, which is the cause of most of our misery.
And it comes largely from academics. This is the very interesting thing. The neoliberalism 100%. Comes from academics, what I call blackboard economists, right? So what you have this bizarre situation where you have a fictitious view of the world centered around competition, articulated by people who have tenure, which means they can never get fired themselves.
Yes.
So they're the least competitive creatures in the world.
Who have never operated in a market, by the way.
Yeah, of course they haven't, right? Yeah.
Like they have no idea what actually happened.
They live in a world, what I call, of academic Brezhnevism. So they live in Leonid Brezhnev's Soviet Union. Not bad. Nobody was really getting killed that much. It was all kind of moving around, right? But the seeds of this intellectual movement come from academia.
Yes.
Is it because, just take the ideology out and let's look at the sort of, your opinion always depends on who pays your wages. Is it because of the privatization of research in the United States that you believe that they've gravitated towards that? So that all these think tanks, all these sort of entities that are reinforcing that, the Cato Institute and all these sort of places, reinforcing these messages are captured by very wealthy people?
Yeah, so you ask a very, very good question. I can't answer it, but I can guess at it. So there are two things. First of all, that academic economics, for whatever reason, veered towards this highly mathematized approach. And I've always called it physics envy.
It is physics envy, right?
This idea that, you know, if we can just mathematize this stuff enough, then we can make predictions as accurate as physicists can make.
Yep.
So that happened. And there were a lot of very smart, well-meaning people who took this path. By the way, if you read their work, they're always like, look, this is not true. It's just a way to look at it. Don't take this too seriously, so on and so forth. But then when you combine that with the narrow self-interest of the wealthiest people who tend to be business leaders and therefore theoretically should have the best perspective on how markets work, that blended into an ideological bulldozer that pushed everything else out of the way. You know, to me, there are two kinds of stupid in the world. The first kind of stupid is, you know, folks who just, you know, can't multiply 9 by 7 and just struggle with basic concepts. And I have high regard and sympathy for folks who find themselves in that circumstance. But the second kind of stupid in the world are people who cannot disentangle what is true about the world from what they want, right? In other words, the people who believe that anything they do must be righteous by definition and the rest of the world is all screwed up. And so, you know, I am surrounded by business leaders, by business people who are absolutely convinced that everything they do is righteous, that every dollar they make is earned, that every problem in society was caused by somebody else, right?
Absolutely.
Like, it is so distressingly pathetic. But it is typical of people because everyone wants to be the hero of their own story. And so, you know, neoliberalism is manna from heaven for
rich
business
guys,
people, right? Like, it's just, like I said, it's a protection racket for them, for us. And so anyway, it's the combination of those two things that came together in this incredibly unfortunate way. And, you know, again, here we are. You know, I do, at the risk of sounding melodramatic, I really do believe that many of the world's biggest problems were caused by this strain of academic economics. Because in a society where everybody's doing well, like almost everything else gets taken care of, right?
So let's come back to the middle income, middle family, the sort of what political scientists would call the ballast of society, the people who have a stake in society, and the stake is sufficiently large that they just want a gradual, slow upward progression. Oh. And what you said is, from your understanding of Biden really feels this.
Yes.
His nemesis, who is doing well in the polls, but not as well as I suspect he thinks he is.
Yes, correct.
Has a totally different view of the United States, a sort of an apocalyptic, sort of dystopian view of where the United States could go. I'm just not mentioning.
Yeah, comparing Trump to Biden is like comparing, you know, a human to a monkey. You know, Trump has no economic beliefs. He's just a narcissistic sociopath, right? He doesn't care about anything but himself. And so his beliefs are simply aligned with what he thinks the best strategy for power is. So I don't think it's fair to compare Biden to Trump. He's just a piece of shit. And that's it. And if you take it more seriously than that, you misunderstand what you're dealing with. I do think it's true to compare Biden to Mitt Romney.
Yeah. You have a discussion.
That's right. Who is an intelligent person of high moral character, but who definitely has a very different view of the economy and everything than Biden does. And I think Mitt Romney, who I'm just using as sort of the canonical example of the opposite of Biden today, also believes that we should help the middle class, but it has the neoliberal way of seeing economic cause and effect so deeply baked in his head that he can't get out of his own way, right? Like he cannot stop believing that tax cuts for the rich are the thing that will create growth.
It's the management consultant approach to society, which is that there's a company comes in here and it's limping and it's bad, and we have a list of off-the-shelf solutions, and away we go. But it's all based on shareholder value, and therefore you start with the premise, and the premise is wrong. So yeah, of course you could probably...
Exactly. And you have to remember that Mitt Romney built his career implementing shareholder value, Max.
I know.
His entire career was predicated on that idea. So it's quite awkward to become president and be like, oh, that was wrong.
Yeah, exactly. let's pull up, because the great thing about this conversation is that you're coming to Kilkenomics, right? So people who listen to this bizarre show of ours, right, tend to come down to Kilkenny.
Yes.
So let's end, I wouldn't say an optimistic note, but let's end on a sort of a possibility note. Do you think, because I always think that everybody is capable of reform and change and the ability to basically say, actually, I was wrong there. Do you think that amongst the very wealthy, because last week we spoke about the fact that in Florence, where I was a while ago, what was very, very clear is the wealthy in Florence in the medieval age, they kind of looked around and said, okay, if we want to keep these shekels in our back pocket, we're going to have to build piazzas. We're going to have to build orphanages. We're going to have to build a city. We're going to have to, you know, basically they gave back enormously. Maybe not because they were really nice guys, but because they realized that the pitchforks might come if they don't spread it around.
Yeah.
Do you see any hope or reason for optimism amongst the wealthy in America that they're saying, hold on a second, the idea that me, and it's the same in Ireland, because we've lots and lots of tax exiles, right? I make a fortune in Ireland. The first thing I do is I go and live in a tax shelter. I don't pay tax. And there's a sort of a heroic amongst that class, there's a heroic, oh, you did the right thing, which again comes from neoliberalism. Do you think there's any sense in the United States, the wealthy are saying, hold on a second, something gives here. We've got to figure it out ourselves, and give back.
Yeah, no, I don't. I think there's no hope.
After all that, because there I was. It was a leading question. We were setting it all up.
I think there's no hope. So what you have to recognize is that one of the worst things about neoliberalism is that it confers an advantage on the worst people.
Explain that to me.
So if you live in a world, if you believe that the purpose of the corporation is to maximize shareholder value, and that when you do, the world is made a better place, that the higher the profits are, the more righteous you are as a leader, as an executive or as a board member, and you take that to its logical extension, then literally anything you do in the service of maximizing corporate profits is socially and morally justified. And if you are the type of person who truly does not care about other people, who's, let's say, a little bit on the spectrum, and has a lot of trouble connecting emotionally with other people, then you have a massive advantage. Because if you can run your enterprise in a way where you simply don't care about the people who work for you, and you simply really don't care about the harm your product creates in the marketplace, and you simply don't care about the future of your country or your society, then your ability to make that company big and successful is much greater than somebody who cares, right? Who's always balancing the profits against, you know, the welfare of the people you work with and so on and so forth. And if you look at the richest people in America today, they share some characteristics. They're all a little bit on the spectrum, aren't they?
A lot of them, what seems to me, I mean, you can have very, very emotionally intelligent people who are actually also very, very greedy and also...
Yes.
But I do think you're right. I do think what you're saying is it's a suite of beliefs that you carry around with you. And if carry that suite of beliefs around with you, and they're based on the notion of shareholder value, just so everybody knows, if we've shareholder value concept really articulated by Jack Welch at GE, and the idea was, and again, he was
Invented by
Milton Friedman. So he's informed by Milton Friedman.
Milton Friedman, that's right.
Again, another academic. That basically the only thing a chief executive has to do is maximize the profits for shareholders in the company. So it doesn't matter about consumers. Doesn't matter about workers, doesn't matter about the product, doesn't matter about the environment. None of that stuff matters. Or not even your product, your intermediaries, your people who buy for you, all that doesn't matter, right? So as long as you believe that idea, which we would call it a highly reductionist worldview.
Yes.
You don't necessarily have to be on the spectrum or not to believe that. Once you believe that, and once you go with that idea, the logical conclusion is you will run at a society to maximize profits for a tiny amount of people.
That's right. And that's where the United States has ended up, right? And so, you know, the idea that Elon Musk is going to wake up one morning and be like, oh my gosh, I should take care of my workers or, you know, care about the broader public or whatever it is. I mean, Elon Musk clothes his narcissism in, you know, saving the world and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, these are people who do not care about other people very much. And they are under a huge amount of societal and social pressure to continue to not care about other people, right? Because that's what their boards require. That's what Wall Street requires.
It gives them status.
You know, that's right. And so hoping that these folks wake up one morning and be like, wait, we need to lead a different life is, I think, hopeless. That's the bad news. The good news is there's 1% of them or 0.1% of them and 99% of the people who are listening to this podcast. The people who are listening to this podcast do not need Jeff Bezos and Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk to agree that rich people should pay taxes. All they have to do is mobilize collectively to make sure that politicians tax these people, right? You know, it's 99-1. This is not even a fair fight in a democracy. But to do that, you have to have an economic ideology that also justifies that shows people that actually the society will not be harmed if these people pay more taxes. The society will not be harmed if their companies are required to pay their people enough to get by without food stamps and taxpayer assistance, right? Like, to me, that's the brass ring, that what you're doing is so important, because what we have to do is get people to mobilize around these sensible economic policies. And if we do, then it doesn't matter what Jeff Bezos thinks.
Nick, can I just ask you a quick question there? Because absolutely speak my language. I agree with pretty much everything you've said. But when I'm talking about this with people in the pub, usually...
Always, actually.
Yeah, I always get the pushback that if you overtax the rich, the entrepreneurs, the innovators and all the rest, it'll disincentivize them and blunt their drive to create more and to be entrepreneurial.
Yeah, pretty good question.
Okay, but you know, Elon Musk is worth $100 billion. You think he would be less motivated if he had $70 billion?
True.
I mean, let me address that. So in terms of motivation, what you have to remember is that people are not motivated by an absolute number. The thing about the people at the very tippy top is that they are the most ambitious people too, right? It takes pathological ambition to be Jeff Bezos, to be Elon Musk. You have to be a maniac to end up there. And those people are competing with one another. Those people would be just as competitive playing a game of marbles. It doesn't matter. So if they all collectively earned half as much, they would be equally competitive. They're not trying to get to a particular number. They're trying to beat the next person. So this is why rich people being less rich is not harmful to a society, even to them. So if rich people in America, for example, made half as much take-home pay, then the homes that they wanted to buy would cost correspondingly less.
Yeah.
Because nobody could bid up the prices, right? Like everything would normalize, except most people would be better off. So that's the first thing. And again, in the United States, people like Elon Musk don't pay any tax at all. He didn't pay any tax because he doesn't take any income because he just borrows money against his assets. So the idea that Jeff Bezos wouldn't work anymore if he had to pay 33% of his income in taxes is so absurd. It's just crazy. Now, if it was 90%, you could start to make that argument. But at least in the United States, if we raised the capital gains rate from 20 to 35% or something like that, and made sure that everybody paid their fair share, you know, nobody's incentives are going to go down very much, and we'd raise a lot more money. You know, like it's just, we are not at the 90% rate here. We're at a very low rate. So anyway, that's what I think.
Nick, we are going to leave it there. I will see you in Kilkenny in a couple of months' time, and hopefully we'll have you back on the pod if you fancy it between now and then.
Anytime. Great. I'd love to talk to you.
Great.
Anytime.
Thanks so much, Nick.
Thank you so much for having me, you guys.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Nick, certainly, as I said there to him...
You're sort of guy, John.
He speaks my language, except I'm not as rich, clearly.
Only a matter of time. Only a matter of time.
Well, I bloody well hope so.
Yeah, exactly. When that horse at Newmarket comes in, you'll be all fine. Place your bets.
It's my Bitcoin. Is going to...
Exactly. No, but fascinating stuff.
Absolutely. Actually, brilliant.
There's
stuff.
A great book, about 20 years old now, called The Winner Takes All Society by an economist called Robert Frank. And right. it's just exactly about what happens when societies turn into markets like sports markets. So basically, the big idea here is that in the past, those sort of rewards went to sports people or entertainers.
Yeah.
And now they're going to all sorts of other professions and those people. So it's driving a wedge between the average guy and these kind of out of sight guys.
But as you said, like, you know, his whole idea of taxing the rich, which I think is a really good one, but it's actually based on self-preservation more than anything else.
Yeah. Like, I mean, it is. It's you know, taxes for the rich, what I would call it's a disaster insurance policy for the very rich, the plutocrats, right? Because what he's saying is that eventually society is going to actually seethe and unravel.
Yeah.
And people are going to come for them. Right? Yeah. Because of the inequality.
I think they're at the gates at the moment.
The barbarians are at the gate, but we're the barbarians, right?
Absolutely.
No, but what I found very interesting, he's talking about those guys, they compete with themselves.
Yeah.
Right? And just a nice little gem on that, right? So really rich people try to outdo themselves when it comes to mad spending.
Yeah.
It's all positional. And the best I ever heard was Aristotle Onassis, who married Jackie Kennedy.
The shipping guy,
right? And in an effort to distinguish himself from the other super rich, did something quite extraordinary, right? In the bar of his mega yacht. He had a mega yacht, and of course it's a willy waving competition.
Yeah.
But he took willy waving to an extreme, John. Because what he did was he covered the bar stools with a whale's foreskin. A soft foreskin of a blue whale.
Did you not just slip off the seats?
Just, you're sitting on the biggest prick in the world, right? But think about it, right? That's what he did. Wow. Now, that's how mad, right?
Really?
Yeah. So his picadillo was to tell people when they were sitting down having their tequila or having their margarita or having their cocktail, behold, you are sitting on a whale's foreskin. And only I have seats that are made out of whale's foreskins and nobody else has. So if you think rich men are sensible, they're all fucking bonkers. We'll talk to you next week.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run futuretools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.